a different issue for you, but it's also going to be something that's going to be very important for how we work on it at the state level. And in terms of the preemption, you know that I've ended up talking a lot about the preemption issues both for the city and the county in Salem, because we have some real problems down there in terms of how they understand how to deal with it. But we have also had a compromise take place with the marijuana bill that dealt with how different groups, different communities wanted to deal with sales. And that's part of the compromise and the discussion that takes place. So that this is an ongoing process, and I don't expect that we're going to have a final say on this, but I'm really looking forward to see how well the city of Portland handles it.
Thank you very much. I don't think that answer is going to get you in trouble. This
oh, yeah, it will.
Future Senator Frederick, to the extent that you can engage in this process without offending your future colleagues, I'd ask you to help in explaining the kind of conduct that we're afraid might still be allowed under the legislative bill, but it wouldn't under this ordinance. And I'll just throw out what my understanding is one of the major concerns is. The legislature simply banned the box in the initial written application. It's my understanding that the legislative action wouldn't prevent an employer from asking as the first question out of the box, no pun intended, in the interview, do you have any criminal history?
That part of the discussion was something that was part of the discussion in the legislature and how you handle that. I think that your ordinance will take the next step, and I think it's appropriate to take that next step. And see if we can in fact get that accomplished so that we can see what really happens rather than the hypotheticals that get thrown out rather constantly. I think you have hit upon an approach that says let's wait until you can see what the skill set is, what the talent, what the enthusiasm is for a candidate before you start to try to eliminate them. And I know that there's a desire to, just in terms of time, I don't want to have to deal with this number of people. Well, okay, I understand that. But, you know, at a certain point, we've already seen what that does. It really doesn't matter. I've in my past, applying for jobs in Oregon, in Portland, recall my application being thrown out and then going back to the same institution and finding out that they had lost it. And then they lost it and they lost it and they lost it before I even got a chance to talk with anyone. I think that this allows us to begin the process of changing that level playing field. That's really getting to that. So that's how I look at that. I'm sorry, I really can't see a problem with waiting until you make that decision.
Ms. Harmon-Johnson, since you don't have to worry about offending your fellow legislators, am I outlining one of your concerns about the legislative language in saying that it would still allow an employer, as the first question in an interview, to ask about criminal history?
Sure. It means that nothing much has changed, right? As an employer, I am looking for ways to exclude candidates at the initial and even at the second phase. Often when I post a position, there are far more candidates than I have the time or interest to interview. So I'm looking for reasons to not interview people. I'm looking for reasons to not schedule folks to come in the door, whether it's typos in their resume or something else, right? So when I do get folks in the door, if I've had to, whatever it is, I'm still looking for ways to figure out who's not the right candidate. So then I can zero in and really spend some quality time with those who are the right candidate. So thank you very much, Mr. Novick, for your application. So have you ever, been convicted of a crime? That's great. Thank you very much for coming in. You have a nice day. Amanda Fritz, thank you very much for coming in today, and so on and so forth. That will certainly save me some time, but it doesn't do much in terms of changing the game for the candidates who have served their time, who are ready and willing and able to work, and who should have at least the opportunity to tell employers who they are, to show their skills and their talents as Representative Frederick just mentioned. That's what this ordinance does that the state legislature failed to do in its work.
Thank you very much. Mr. Price, welcome back to the council chambers.
Thank you for having us. So my name is Emmanuel Price. I'm the founder of SCAFE, Second Chances Are for Everyone. It is a nonprofit to help men and women after they get out of incarceration. It may sound a little jargony, but I just want to read and make sure I hit every point. While state law to ban the box was important, it simply removes the box from job applications. People with histories are often encouraged to honestly disclose their histories. We need an ordinance in the city of Portland that can actually connect people with past convictions to jobs that will build better families, stronger communities. These entry-level positions are the jobs that are most desirable and accessible for those with felony backgrounds. And when we, because I am a convicted felon as well, when we voluntarily and honestly disclose our background on applications, the opportunity for an interview is decreased by 100%. The opportunity to gain employment is also decreased by 100%. This I know to be accurate because I serve the population of people that I'm speaking on behalf of. And we all have the same scenario when it comes to looking for jobs, employment, housing, healthcare, even education sometimes. Not only is this true for me, as a person with a felony background, my conviction is 19 years old. And as a 38-year-old single father, it creates unnecessary barriers for me. Over the years, it has hurt me and hindered me when I haven't been able to provide for my family due to the barriers that have prevented my consideration for jobs that I've experienced and the skill set to do. This is an opportunity for the city of Portland to help increase employment opportunities for those who have past convictions that apply for entry-level positions. With this ordinance and support, unstable communities become more fragile, people become more dependent on social services, while less likely to be employed. Lastly, this may sound a little snarky, but with all due respect, no, seriously, people are able to vote immediately when they are released from prison. So the same people that we're talking about can vote each and every one of you into office and have actually put their ballot and voted you into office. So we trust when we put our ballot and when we vote and when we sign our signature, when we vote for you, that you will have our best interest at heart. And when we cast those ballots and we vote and we see people in office, and then we come and we make this case for a simple living, we don't even get that. This is an extremely large population of people that anybody can have access to, that should be paid more attention to, because it's growing population. And when they get out, they can vote for you. They can vote for me. They can vote for the next young African-American Latino person who wants to run for office. So not only pass this ordinance, but also look at it from kind of a selfish standpoint, like, oh, I could do another 4 years, because these people will vote. These people want to vote. We want to get out and work and take care of ourselves and our families. And, you know, lastly, I appreciate the time that you guys are taking to show attention to this. And this is a serious matter. I'm 38. My conviction is 19 years old. But I still have the same barrier when I apply for any job. When I was 24, I applied for a job at Arby's. I thought I was above food service and, you know, I didn't want to be working in that environment. But they didn't even hire me because of my past conviction. And I had been out maybe 4 years at the time. So it's not like people don't want to work. We want to work. Nobody wants to go to jail and sit there and rot and do nothing, but at least afford that opportunity for people to come out and be able to have an interview. Like Michael Alexander said, let us show our work history and showcase our talents rather than be judged on, oh yeah, Mr. Price, you have a conviction. Let's just push that application aside. I live this every day. I'm not just up here speaking from no experience. I work with these people every day. And I hear the same story over and over and over because I live it. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you all very much. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Our next panel is Bill Dickey, Tom Chamberlain, and London Elliott.
You're on first, Bill. My name is Bill Dickey. I am a business owner in Northeast Portland. I have between 25 and 40 employees, depending on the season of the year. It's interesting. I went back and picked out an application for an employee that I hired in 2004, and I didn't have the box on my application then, so apparently I self-banned in this situation. And I do have employees involved in the company who have criminal backgrounds. I think that we, in general, life's about second chances, and just continually getting second chances when you make mistakes. But this ordinance that I'm in favor of takes it a step further than the state law and sort of educates us to moves the employers and teaches the employers to do the thing that isn't obvious. In other words, right now it's obvious, and it was a great example. I'm not sure the woman's name, the city lawyer who was here, who said it's obvious when a woman walks in and she's pregnant, you're not going to ask her questions about, whether her pregnancy or her family are going to be deterrents to her job. This rule of asking this question after you make the decision is just sort of a way for us to move ourselves a little further along and help change a societal problem that we have that is something that we're addressing now, that which is great. Other things got addressed earlier, but this one is just another thing that we need to do to make our situation better, and it is great that the city of Portland is taking the opportunity to lead the way on this, because we have the ability to do that. And currently, right now, this is completely aside from this, but there's stuff going on social media right now that is just crazy ever since the Paris attacks. And that kind of prejudice that's going on, it really bothers me greatly. And it's embarrassing. I honestly sit at red lights on occasion and think, why do these people think differently than I do? Just in general. Because I live here and I love this place. And, so anyway, I just think that this is a great opportunity, and I'm definitely in favor of it. And I'm also a member of the Portland Business Alliance, in case anybody wanted to know about that. I guess that's all from me. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. London, would you like to be next? Welcome back to the Council Chambers.
Thank you so much. It's nice seeing you all again. As you said, my name is London. I'm 18 years old, and I'm a third-generation born and raised Portlander. My father, my brother, and several other family members have records. To me, that has meant a life of unemployment resulting in instability for all of us. Not having access to employment changes how society, your community, and your family sees you. Most importantly, how you see yourself, resulting in a lack of confidence, opportunity, and hope. This despair affects every relationship in that person's life, such as relationship between parent and child, taking away one of the most fundamental relationships in life, and far too often setting the stage for that child to repeat the path of the parent. Growing up, I experienced what it was like not having access to employment. I had the fear of coming home from school to see eviction notices and past due bills. Have you guys ever eaten sleep for dinner? You guys know what that means? That makes you feel powerless, especially since you see your family trying so hard. Mass incarceration and subsequent joblessness is a problem all across Oregon. But if I'm being honest, it's reached epidemic levels for my community here in Portland. In a city like Portland, where far too often I see people who look like me treated as if they are guilty until proven innocent, Many of my peers and friends are already on a lifelong journey towards recidivism and chronic unemployment. This is something that the city of Portland has the opportunity to fix. Oregon already took the first step, but Portland can lay down a path towards success for people like me and my community. I urge you to pass this ordinance without delay and help thousands of families like mine in Portland. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chamberlain, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor Katz, commissioners.
Oops, no, that was an
I was thinking about that.
Whoa. Wow. Tom?
I've been at this job way too long.
That's high praise, but
yeah. It's been a... Mayor Hales, glad to be here, too.
I'm right there.
I'm here today on behalf of the 300,000 men and women of the Oregon AFL-CIO and encourage you to take swift action on this ordinance. We represent a broad coalition of groups that have come together to advocate to ban the box. And previous testimony, you heard that the state of Oregon has taken an initial step, a critical step, an important step, but a step that doesn't go far enough. It may be a good policy, but it's not an excellent policy. We're the city of Portland. We believe in second chances. We're the city of Portland. We're a national leader. We're the city of Portland. We just don't go along to get along. I expect great things from the city. And moving forward with a policy that just mimics what the state did isn't enough. We need a policy that really does something, that really gives ex-felons a second chance for a better life. And while this may be more than other cities have done, other states have done, it's important that Portland does more than they do. We encourage fast action on this. We support this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much for your help. Thank you all. Questions? Thank you all very much. We have one more invited speaker, and we'll see if the technology supports her arrival, and that's Michelle Natividad Rodriguez from the National Employment Law Project. So I believe we have her set up to Skype in. We'll see if that actually works. Carla is attempting to make that connection.
PCM is doing that.
Okay. Give us a moment, folks, to there she is. Good afternoon, Michelle.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Great. I am having trouble hearing you, but I can go ahead and share some thoughts. Thank you so much for having me and using the technology to get me in here. Just a little bit of background about myself. I'm a senior staff attorney with the National Employment Law Project, and we've worked for the last several years with jurisdictions across the country, policymakers and advocates on fair chance laws and ban the box laws. And I myself personally was involved in the San Francisco Fair Chance Ordinance, and I worked 3 years on that. I worked 2 years on the California legislation personally as well. That was just a straightforward ban the box, and have been involved in a variety of the movements that have happened, including recently with President Obama's announcement that did apply to federal agencies as well. So that's my background, and what we tried to do in situations that policymakers like yourselves are facing is to gather the information about what's working, what's not working, and to help you in ensuring that you are doing what you can with the goals that you want to achieve, which is, I think, what we can all agree on. We have a broken criminal justice system. We have seen the impact on our community. We have heard the heartbreak and pain just even in today of what that's caused. And so we are committed to doing all we can. And that means getting people jobs. That means taking away the unnecessary barriers. And so we all have that shared goal. And then the question becomes, how do we do that well? How do we make sure that the laws that we can put in place will actually accomplish that goal? And I just want to evoke a little bit of what of what Bill shared from his perspective as a business person that I thought hit it right on the head. What this law does, what it has the opportunity to do, is really educate employers and teach them how to take the bias out of the hiring process. It starts to address how can we make a cultural shift, because really what we're dealing with, as you heard from Mr. Price and others, is a deeply stigmatized population. And because of that deep stigma, we have to take very seriously having the laws in place that are going to make an impact. So that's our starting point. And what I want to do is just cover a couple of details that have been raised. And I have been listening in, and there were a few questions that were directed my way. So I will try to address them as well. One point that I did want to share that I noticed, which I think is a very common misunderstanding, and it comes into your question of thinking about exemptions. I heard references to when there are these heightened public safety concerns, we need to ensure that we have enough exemptions. Now, I just want to point out to everyone, and I think that this is a very natural misunderstanding, is that your process, the laws that you laid out here, even without the exemptions, makes your hiring process and your public safety concerns, addressing those, no less rigorous. Alameda County is an example of a jurisdiction that has had this in place since 2007, when their HR person came before the California legislature about their experiences with a more comprehensive fair hiring law that included the conditional offer threshold. They made it very clear this did not change how rigorous their process was, even in heightened safety positions. And when I think about as well the example of some of the most safety-sensitive positions in our country, which is under national security, I will just also point to the fact that the Office of Personnel Management, who is in charge of those national security jobs, also recommends waiting to the conditional offer stage before a background check is given. Now, why is that? It's because it does not change the fact that you can still do the analysis that's needed. The benefit of that, just period, is what we've seen, is that for most of these jobs, what you're going to find is most convictions that people have are not going to be job related. And I point to the experiences in San Francisco. They recently released a report under their current analysis of how their jobs are considered. And they found of the amount of people that had conviction records, when they did their own job analysis and looked at job relatedness, in the end, they only found that 2% total should be disqualified. So it's all to say you have a very low percentage, if you're actually looking at job relatedness, of individuals that should be disqualified from a job position, period. So those are some of the broad points that I just wanted to cover. And then drilling into a couple of questions that were raised, there was a question about voluntary disclosure. And I actually thought that Judy and Josh did a great job of addressing that. The concern with a voluntary disclosure and having that included in the law is that you're not really going to see the kind of cultural shift that the law is intended to create, which is that you want this conversation to happen after the conditional offer phase. The reason for that is because you're trying to minimize the bias in the process. And the way that other jurisdictions have handled this is much as the way that Josh and Judy described. You can do it with a notice at the beginning to indicate that any discussion of a conviction record will happen after the conditional offer. That's the path that San Francisco has taken and some others. You can also say, you know, during the job interview phase, right at the beginning as an employer, you know, we're going to talk about the background check, not at this time. So there are very simple ways to deal with that. And the benefit of it, of course, is that you're really aiming at the kind of cultural shift and the de-biasing that the hope of these laws are trying to make happen. You're getting closer to that. I also just want to harken back to a point that one of the commissioners made, which I think is a very important one around enforcement. We found with jurisdictions across the country that really the difficulty is not with employers, you know, facing a gotcha situation. Employers are finding that they can meet the standards such as conditional offer and job relatedness just fine. The problem has been enforcement. We are not seeing as many people coming forward. There's a lot of reasons for that. One of them being that already job applicants, people with records, are in vulnerable situations. You're already dealing with individuals that are not going to be as willing to come forward. So keeping that in mind, we want to make sure that we're not getting into a situation of he said, she said, as the commissioner indicated. We want to ensure that enforcement can be as solid as possible, and just generally, that's something to keep in mind. You don't want to be in the position that some jurisdictions are in now, which is trying to go back to their prior law to make improvements so that it's not a law in name only, but it's actually working on the ground. I'm happy to drill down into any further questions that you may have or any particulars. We do have a lot of materials and experience with other jurisdictions that I'm happy to share.
Michelle, thank you very much. I think there are a couple of questions from members of the council, so hope you can hear us.
Ms. Rodriguez, can you hear us?
Yes, sounds like she can.
We can't hear her now.
Well, we'll see if we can. We'll see if we can make this work and see.
Can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay, there we go. So it's Nick Fish, and I appreciated the what you said, just your most recent comment about the he said, she said. And I'll just give you an example. I, in a prior life, represented someone who had a claim of discrimination based on retaliation for opposing HIV discrimination. It was a retaliation claim. And the key evidence in the case was the employer putting in writing the reasons for the termination. And because the reasons were legally insufficient, it was the key piece of evidence to show that they didn't have a good faith basis. And so that's what is in the back of my mind. Is it unduly burdensome to require, in your judgment, to require that the withdrawal of the conditional offer, the explanation for that withdrawal be in writing?
I don't believe it is so, for the very reason that you mentioned. If this is going to be something that you have working in practice, we have to think of the mechanisms to ensure that it does. And certainly to be able to say in writing, this is the reason for the denial, helps ensure that the employer is going through an analysis. And as well, it can help the applicant see what the issue is, and it will help enforcement. In the end, by having that clarity, I think that everybody in the process will not have to go through the back and forth of the he said, she said,
right.
Which would just take the enforcement agency's time to try to figure that out. You get the benefit of clarity with writing, and I think that that's what your point is trying to say.
And I assume that it doesn't matter what form the writing takes, whether it's a document, an email, or whatever. It's something in writing.
Exactly. I think that the point being that we have some kind of documentation that indicates what the rationale is, even if it's very simple. There are some jurisdictions that have even provided a copy of the background check and literally highlighted what the issue was. It can be as simple as that.
One last question. When you look around the country, what's an example of a city that has gotten this right? And how do you measure success?
It's a very good question. Thank you for that. You know, part of the larger issue here is that we're not seeing a lot of cities and counties, and I sympathize, but we're not seeing a lot of them collect the data. And so we are not seeing what the problems are as clearly. What we'll see is the number of complaints that are filed and how those are resolved. But I do encourage you, for what you can, for your contractors or for the city itself, to actually look at the number of people that are being hired who have records, so that at least you can identify yourself, is our law working? Maybe that's not as practical for the employers themselves, but it is something we're trying to explore. So that's kind of a side note. This larger question of what I've seen working from jurisdictions are a couple of points. One, the District of Columbia in their ordinance, which became effective in December 2014, which does have the conditional offer threshold, has stated in a letter, I think that you may have that letter, in fact, that the conditional offer threshold has been very helpful for their enforcement. As well, they've had an amount of penalties go to complainants. Now, the reason that they had a certain amount of penalty go to complainant is for the very reason that I alluded to earlier. Workers that are low income, that have records, are not going to have as much time, period, to come forward and make a complaint, especially if they don't see how that's going to get them that particular job immediately. So you're asking individuals who don't have a lot of time, who need to take care of their family, to come forward to a government agency that they probably don't trust, to make it better for the next people after them, which is a wonderful altruistic thing to do, but it's not something that a lot of people have the luxury for. And so in the District of Columbia, they found that by having that small amount of the penalty go to the complainant, they're actually compensating people a little bit for their time that they are giving to help ensure that the law is being enforced properly. I will also say that I have been impressed with the outreach and education efforts and the dedication of resources for that for Seattle, for the District of Columbia, and for San Francisco as well. One of the things that hasn't worked as well for San Francisco is that they have very low penalties. And it's not to say that they aren't working with employers, and most employers don't mean the best and won't try to follow the letter of the law. It's just very difficult for them to have employers who are not taking the law seriously pay any attention to them when their penalties are so low. So their hands are tied as an enforcement agency in that regard because of their low penalty structure. And it's probably going to have to be something that we go back and try to change in the law, which is going to be a difficult process. So I would recommend that you don't take those steps and you try to get it right at the first.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Other questions from Ms. Rodriguez? Thank you so much for being part of this process today, and you've added a lot of value and clarity to our deliberations, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move now to folks that have signed up to speak in addition to the ones that we already heard from that were invited. I know that we probably still have a few of you here who would like to speak, so let's go to the sign-up sheet and see who remains.
I have a total of 9 people signed up. The first 3, please come on up, are Mikhail Shabazz, Christina Gage, and Crystal Ilinski. Let's go with Kaja Rutledge.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I am Mikhail Shabazz, Mr. Mayor and Council. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I am a director of OICO, the Oregon Islamic Chaplains Organization. We are a part of Mercy Corps Northwest Reentry Coalition, which is a faith-based coalition. We've been in place for about 15 years. We provide in-reach services in most of Oregon's prisons, as well as reentry services for those who are post-incarcerated. And I'm here today to support, not only to support this change in code, but to promote it. I think it's a big step in the right direction for those who are facing the obstacles that we've all discussed today, the long list of difficulties that people face, men and women coming out of these prisons, are endless. And I think it is very important that the education process that's being spoken of here extends itself to the intended recipients, i.e., it's one thing to inform the community outside, but we have to do the inreach on the inside with the individuals who are incarcerated and will be coming out so that they know and understand that this is now a new opportunity or a renewed opportunity for them to find employment, and that there is some teeth in the code that will allow them to, God willing, obtain the employment that they're seeking to obtain. So I think it's very important that we go both ways with what's being projected. And I would like to also suggest, after listening to all this wonderful testimony, that the city regularly encourages inclusion, participation, diversity, inclusion, et cetera, and it somewhat rewards those contractors who comply and who show good faith efforts in this manner. And perhaps somewhere along the line, as you're drafting all these rules and regulations and codes, et cetera, that could be considered as well, that when looking at particularly those who are contracting to the city, if they have the means of being vetted to see if they are actually offering employment to those who are applying that have criminal backgrounds, and if they're offering employment to them and they're doing the outreach and they're making it known that they are open to do business with people and that they are not checking them off at the door, that they also be given some measure of recognition for doing so. And that would perhaps encourage them to be more forthcoming. The organizations that I work with, Miracles, for instance, HARP, which is another organization, Phoenix Rising, Women of Purpose. There are many organizations that are in the reentry community that can utilize this law in our arsenal when it comes to assisting people that are transitioning out of prison and into community life. So to wind it up, I'm here to support it. I think that this is a great move. I understand the dynamics that are taking place. And the city of Portland, I think, not only have the opportunity, you as the mayor and the council, have the opportunity to set the bar, but also to set the example. I've worked for the city of Portland for 20 years in outreach, recruitment, et cetera, programs through Commissioner Leonard, understanding how to bring people into the workforce that did not traditionally have access through skills, et cetera. So I think if the city itself bans the box and then sets the example, then others will be more likely to follow. So I just want to, again, thank you all for what you're doing. It's very important what you're doing. It's meaningful. It's very meaningful to people to know that they have a chance. Some of the individuals that I deal with and that my organization deal with, we see them go in prison. We started our organization 15 years ago, and some of them are still there on their way out. And we see people that go in with many years ahead of them, and we see the life change. But when the life takes a change, it also needs to have hope that those changes can be executed. And bread and butter, are core values and core issues. People have to be able to maintain themselves. We either work with them, let them know that they can work for us, or they have no other alternative than to work against us. And I'm a businessman also. I have a plumbing company, and it is my protocol also to bring into my shop those who have criminal backgrounds. And in today's society, I think most of us will find we have a little criminal in us. We just haven't gotten accounted for. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Good evening.
Hi, Mayor Hales and commissioners. My name is Christina Gage. I work for a company called Higher Image, which is a background screening firm. I'm also a member of the National Association of Professional Background Screeners. and I'm here today on behalf of the NAPBS. NAPBS represents more than 825 companies nationwide, many of whom work with businesses within the city of Portland, providing the public with safe places to live and work. Our member companies are defined as consumer reporting agencies, and we're regulated by both the Federal Trade Commission and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We appreciate the opportunity to offer our professional insight on whether or not Portland should impose increased restrictions on criminal background checks above and beyond what's already regulated by the FTC under the FCRA, as well as what's impending with HB 3025. And for the following reasons, we are going to say we oppose this change, of course. The biggest issue we're seeing is that this legislation is imposing itself on top of what's already in existence. We wholeheartedly support, NAPBS wholeheartedly supports providing all consumers with safe places to live and work, and any efforts at helping individuals find gainful employment and avoiding recidivism. And we believe that the ban the box in its purest form, as HB 3025 is presenting in the state of Oregon, will do just that. It's going to go a long way in helping to avoid the situation where employers are just tossing out applications. But we really need to consider what the imposition of additional changes to law would have as it relates to things that already exist on the books. So, for example, Portland's ordinance goes beyond Oregon's because it's requiring that we state the specific reason or specific criminal issue in the criminal history that's a problem for the employer. Well, we already covered that under the FCRA. We're required, or employers are required, any employer that uses a CRA like ours is required to go through a two-step process before they can either rescind an offer or decline employment if they're using that criminal history as a basis for that decision. So they have to go through the pre-adverse process, which requires that they already send the report in its entirety to the applicant. On top of that, then, they have to give a five-day waiting period for that applicant to come back with information that would clear up the history if there was a problem on it. It also gives a time period for the employer to consider whether or not that's relevant to the job. After that, then they can take action and do the final, what's called final adverse action, and go ahead and rescind the offer.
Does that have to be in writing, or can it be oral?
It's in writing, and it's all actually regulated. Wording in terms of the whole process is regulated.
With respect to the federal law you're talking about, mm-hmm. has your experience been that there's a virtue in having it in writing, so there's no misunderstanding of the reasons?
Correct. Yes, absolutely.
That's the exchange we had with the lawyer and. Yes. Trying to bring clarity to this.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole process is governed by you know, very specific rules. So, for instance, we have to provide also the employer provides the FCRA summary of rights before a background check is even done. It's provided again at the point that the report is given to the applicant.
You've raised an important question, so let me just jump to the chase. Do you believe that our requirement is redundant in light of federal law?
I'm getting there.
Okay.
try to get there soon because
we're
running
out of time.
We're running out of time, so I wanted to give you a lifeline.
So in addition to FCRA, the EEOC already provided guidance around individual assessment in 2012. And they provided that in the form of the publication called Consideration of Arrest and Conviction Records and Employment Decisions under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And in that, they provide the same sort of criteria that you're suggesting, is that you look at the actual crime or crimes, the age of the person at the time, what's its relevance to the job being applied for. So all of that's already in place.
But again, the big difference is about timing. Mm-hmm. And the EEOC traditionally did not address the question of timing. It was, and they have another stick, by the way, if they think that employers are wholesale barring people at the front door. But it's about timing. So,
sure.
And admittedly, the proposal on the table has a different timing than your industry enforces nationally. Have you found any particular challenges enforcing the Washington D.C. law, or any other, or Baltimore, or any other city that has taken the approach that we're evaluating?
Well, Well, I think ban the box again in its purest form, which is saying we can't ask on the application, and even the laws that go as far as to say you can't ask until interview, like 3025 is doing, or if no interview until a conditional offer of employment. I think that those in our experience have been wonderful, not a problem. But it's when you start implementing rules around kind of the subjectivity of me evaluating somebody's criminal record and what is it going to look like, how do I put it in writing in the right way, and we've already talked about it with the EEOC and how that should happen. So I think that's been our issue.
So if the council ends up disagreeing with you on the policy matter, what I hear you saying is that there's a body of law, particularly at the EEOC, that you want us to review as guidance as we do our regulations. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah, I hope you'd be willing to be involved in this.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
As well.
That's very helpful.
Good. Thank you so much.
All right,
appreciate thank you. It. Thank you. And as we call the next group, let's include, please, Sonia Skvarla from Social Ignition, because I neglected to call her earlier. So why don't you call two more, Carla?
Okay, Rod Setch and Casey Jama.
Good afternoon or good evening. Sonia, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you. And if you did call my name earlier, I apologize. I was with a client who started business.
Failed to call your name earlier.
Right. So. Okay, perfect. All the better. So my name is Sonia Skvarla, and I run a Social Ignition. You've met me before. I was here at the last hearing at Ban the Box. I work with men who are incarcerated at Columbia River. We talk about entrepreneurial ventures and personal development. So I was there this morning, and through a conversation unrelated to this topic, I was meeting with a gentleman, Jamal, whom you know, and he's getting out in a couple weeks, and he said to me today, I'm going to read it from my note, "My biggest fear is to be judged for the person I was at a point in time 10 years ago versus the person I am now." We talk about timing, about the ban the box, when are we going to ask? And I know that's what this hearing is about, and we all make a decision based on really wonderful evidence. But what I'm concerned about is what this comes down to is the intersection between public safety and discrimination. And regardless of when you ask the question, companies are able to automatically disqualify someone on the mere existence of a criminal record. A Social Ignition and my work is about getting to the root issue. What are we scared of? What are we nervous will happen if we invite someone into our business that we have built? And I would like to see more conversations around that whenever all of you work out the details on the timing before or after any of those, is to really sit down with business owners and say, what are you scared of? What are you nervous about? How can we address those things specifically? Whether it's more education, more programs inside, as the gentleman was saying earlier, more opportunities for people to meet and get to trust each other. That's what this is about at its core, and that's what I would like to see more of as you all decide on timing, when to ask the question, when is it okay for me to discriminate against you, and the work that you've done before. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Rod Such, and I'm reading this statement today on behalf of the Portland chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace. The Portland chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace strongly endorses the mayor's proposed ordinance to remove a barrier that stands in the way of many people seeking an opportunity for a second chance. This proposed ordinance is a significant improvement on recently enacted state legislation and will clarify for many Portland employers the importance that the city attaches to this initiative. Everyone deserves a second chance in life. This is especially true for people of color who face institutional barriers of discrimination and who have been disproportionately affected by our draconian drug sentencing laws in an era of mass incarceration. If you have not yet read Michelle Alexander's groundbreaking study, The New Jim Crow, we strongly urge you to do so. In it, you will learn not only about the racist and political motivations behind many of the get-tough-on-crime laws of the 1970s and 1980s, but also you will become more aware of the lasting impact that felony convictions have on people's lives. These include not only their ability to obtain work, but also to obtain housing and other social services, not to mention disenfranchisement in many states. Why should a Jewish organization weigh in on this issue? JVP is a human rights organization, and equalizing opportunities and employment application is one of the civil rights issues of our day. The civil rights movement of the 1960s lifted all boats. Civil rights legislation made it more difficult for Jewish people to be subjected to restrictive housing covenants and tokenism in hiring and college admissions. At the same time, Jews in this country enjoy white privileges denied to communities of color. It is therefore incumbent on us to align ourselves with those still fighting discrimination and with those still seeking a second chance. Ban the box.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Mr. Jama, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and thank you for commissioners to allowing me to speak in front of you. First of all, Mayor Hells, I want to thank you sincerely for you putting out a statement in support of welcoming refugees in the city of Portland. As a refugee, it meant to me a lot, and it meant to a lot of other folks. And I would encourage all of you other commissioners to do the same thing. We are facing very difficult and challenging time. And again, my name is Casey Chama. I'm the executive director of the Center for Intercultural Organizing. CIO stands shoulder to shoulder with Urban League of Portland, AFL-CIO, and the Fair Shot Coalition in support of banning the box. We believe qualified applicants who have served their time deserve a second chance, a fair chance at finding employment. Portland has an opportunity to lead this issue. We support the ordinance to ban the box, and I encourage you to pass strong ordinance that includes a conditional offer requirement and does not include a loopholes. For years, CIO members and supporters has been waiting for progress here in Portland. We were heartened to see that the state bill passed, but know that it was only first step to addressing this issue. Barriers to end living only perpetuates inequities. It challenges people and denies people to have fair chances to move forward. Personally, I can do a parallel comparison to my own personal experience. 15 years ago, I came to this country and this great city of Portland as a refugee. My resume was as blank as this piece of paper. All I want is someone to give me a chance to work, a chance to earn a living. When I applied and got my first job at the DoubleTree Hotel Lawyer Center, you have no clue how I felt when I got that offer. It made the whole difference to me personally because I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any backup plan. I didn't know anybody in the city of Portland. I was alone by myself. And that first step, the opportunity that I was given, is all the folks here today are asking. Nobody's asking anything else. We want to give an opportunity for people. For that reason, I encourage you to ban the box. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Okay, let's take the next group on this on the list.
The last three people I show signed up are Marion Haynes, Jerry Jimenez, and James Taylor Jimenez. Sorry.
Come on up. Hey, Marianne, I think you're first.
Okay. Good evening, Mayor Hales, council members. My name is Marion Haynes, and I'm with the Portland Business Alliance. I frankly feel like I'm in a very awkward role here before you today. as we have said from the very beginning with this, when this conversation started, we support the goal of banning the box. We supported the bill in Salem to ban the box, so much so that when I was here testifying last time, I remember sitting next to Michael Alexander talking about how the Urban League and the Portland Business Alliance were in violent agreement about the goals that we were trying to accomplish here, and that's absolutely true. It's hard to disagree with a lot of what has been said about the impact that people have when they have a criminal conviction, what that history has been, how that impacts communities of colors. We don't disagree with that, and that is why we support the goal. It's why we understand the value of a job. That being said, our strong preference is to let the state bill work. We've heard a lot today about how it doesn't go far enough, and my question is, how do we know? The state bill hasn't been implemented yet. There's been no data gathered. We haven't seen whether there's a number of claims. We haven't seen whether more people are getting into jobs. That data hasn't been collected. The state employment department is in a position to do that. We just don't know. I think there's been a lot of good questions raised about how jobs will be determined, whether that job fits into the matrix or not, whether a particular job fits into the public safety and business necessity requirement. That will be left up to rules. You know, I know some examples of ones that could fit into those rules, but we don't know the examples of all the jobs out there. Employers are in the best position to know whether that job has a public safety or a business necessity element that a certain criminal conviction, not every criminal conviction, but a certain one may be relevant to. You know, we heard from the Law Center that Alameda County found that wasn't a problem with them. That was for their own positions. They banned their own box, not making a judgment for other private employers. So, again, I think there's been a lot of good questions raised. We strongly believe with the goal. We think that what the state has done was a good step forward, and we ought to let that work be implemented. It's only going to be another month and a half from now, and understand whether that makes the kind of progress that we all would like to see on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening, Mayor Hales, commissioners. I kind of hesitated to come up, but first of all, my name is James Taylor. I've been a homeowner and resident of the city of Portland since 1981, and I've been a banker in the community since 1980. As I said, I hesitated to come up, but after hearing the testimony, and I do applaud the work that's gone into this code, and I applaud the Urban League for taking the steps that they've taken. However, I don't believe that it goes far enough. You know, when I hear that the Senate and the House had two versions, and I guess the watered one won out, and then I hear the city of Portland tackling the same issue, and I applaud you for tackling the issue, but I don't think it's gone far enough. If people that are incarcerated serve their time, they paid their debt to society. I think we can all agree upon that. So banning the box is the correct thing, but I think it should end there. People have paid their dues. Let's ban the box. There should be no additional steps that the individual has to go through to prove their worthiness as a citizen. I understand the business community is pushing for certain concessions, and I can understand why. And that's why, you know, you guys have proposed compromises to appease the business community. But individuals have paid their debts to society. There should be no conditional letter, and then let's find out what crime you did. What's the purpose? I mean, the deputy city attorney testified earlier, and she gave the example of a pregnant woman. If a pregnant woman came into an employer where she appeared to be pregnant, the employer is prohibited by law from asking her certain questions. Now, if that employer wanted to offer her a job and tendered a conditional letter of employment, can that employer then ask her how many kids does she plan on having? How much time does she plan on spending with her kids at home? It's against the law. We have laws, we have civil rights laws, we have employment laws on the books presently to protect discrimination in the workplace. But for some reason, when it comes to people of color, whenever there are laws, there has to be conditions put upon it.
Sir, can I just correct you on one point?
Yes.
You're making a very compelling case, but currently people who have served time and are released to society are not a protected class. And the big difference in the area that you've described are race, gender, status, marital status. Those are all protected classes. So a judgment has been made that they're protected. And so one of the challenges we and everyone else has is how do you structure a system to provide some protections for someone who hasn't been determined to be a protected class? Your point about race is important because disproportionately the people we're talking about happen to be African American.
Correct.
So there's a disparate impact. But just to be clear, the difference between the pregnant